refused to discuss or acknowledge the two studies by his own agency that supported its use. They next questioned him about his sandbagging on aerosol pentamidine. According to Nussbaum, dozens of community doctors and thousands of PWAs, people with AIDS, already knew that aerosol pentamidine prevented AIDS' most lethal symptom, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, PCP. Doctors had also found early intervention with Bactrim and Septra to be effective prophylaxis against PCP. The activists presented Dr. Fauci with a modest request that NIAID agree to make guidelines for physicians who wanted to use Bactrim to treat people with AIDS preventively, or even a statement supporting consideration of the use. An official declaration by NIH that doctors consider these treatments standard of care would require insurance companies to cover their costs, making them available to AIDS victims, many of whom were destitute. Dr. Fauci met both requests with refusal. He said he simply could not recommend a drug until he saw randomized, blinded, placebo-controlled trial results. That was the gold standard, he said. It would be that or nothing. When they asked him why not, he shouted, "There is no data." He told them that the treatment experiences and voluminous case study reports of dozens of community AIDS doctors was not real science. The activists were aware of this increasingly lethal irony. It had been NIAID's decision to not fund any randomized trials on these unpatented drugs. Dr. Fauci himself had constructed this dead end, this pattern of resourceful stonewalling to obstruct repurposed off-patent drugs with life-saving potential, would become a pattern familiar to Dr. Fauci's critics during the COVID crisis. According to Callan, "We asked him, no, we begged him, to issue interim guidelines urging physicians to prophylax those patients deemed at high risk for PCP pneumonia with Bactrim or aerosol pentamidine. Although it would not have cost the government much to have done so, he steadfastly refused to issue such guidelines. His reason? No data." So the catch-22 was complete, and many people died of PCP who didn't have to. When the activists asked Dr. Fauci to at least add AL-721, peptide D, DHPG, and aerosolized pentamidine to his clinical trials, Dr. Fauci's refusal was loud. "I can't do that," he shouted. "I can't convene a consensus conference." The choice, he explained, of which compounds would enter NIAID's clinical trial pipeline was made not by public agreement, but by a panel of independent scientists. Dr. Fauci did not mention that virtually all the members of his independent panel were pharmaceutical PIs with ties to NIAID and Burroughs Wellcome. Following that meeting, a group of frustrated community doctors raised money from their own AIDS patients to collect data for a randomized trial on Bactrim. It took them 2 years, and their results strongly supported Bactrim's effectiveness against pneumonia. AIDS activists lamented that 2 years of stalling by Fauci on aerosol pentamidine and Bactrim had cost 17,000 people their lives. Following the NIH parley, the fury of the AIDS patient advocates against Dr. Fauci mounted. In their view, the community doctors were generating plenty of good science. Those treatment experiences, often published, had as much validity as case studies upon which scientists routinely rely. As Nussbaum points out, there was plenty of data, if only Fauci and the rest of NIH were willing to look at real people in real communities instead of the endless bottoms of their test tubes. Michael Callan told Nussbaum that Dr. Fauci's single-minded concern seemed to be avoiding the mortification of acknowledging success by doctors outside his agency. He would not be humiliated, even if Fauci's decision cost the lives of tens of thousands of people with AIDS. Michael Callan, Larry Kramer, and the other AIDS activists left the NIH sit-down in a fierce rage. In June 1987, at a post-mortem at ACT UP's circus-like New York City headquarters auditorium, where I often spoke on environmental issues during that era, Kramer lambasted Dr. Fauci for his pharma bias. "Where are the drugs the government promised?" he asked. "After we got them millions of dollars for their experiments, what do we get? A $10,000 drug. What about all the other drugs out there?" Congressional Confrontation, April 28, 1988. Dr. Fauci had given Kramer and the other activists the bum's rush. He could not do the same with his congressional patrons. For years, my uncle, Senator Ted Kennedy, the chair of the Senate Health Committee, and Senator Lowell Weicker, who chaired Senate Appropriations, along with their allies in the House, California Congressman Henry Waxman and Manhattan Congressman Ted Weiss, had fought hand-to-hand combat with Ronald Reagan's tight-fisted budget director, David Stockman, to free up money for AIDS research. In 1980, Teddy became the first presidential candidate to actively campaign for gay rights. I stumped with him in San Francisco's Castro District when he shattered political taboos by barnstorming the gay bars, shaking hands, and snapping photos. When the AIDS epidemic broke a year later, Teddy defied convention by hiring Terry Barron, the first openly gay, HIV-infected Senate aide, to stage-manage the legislative battle against AIDS. Barron became the leading national advocate for the community-based clinical trials for remedies like Bactrim and aerosolized pentamidine, to which Dr. Fauci had shown such hostility. Barron had hatched the idea for a community research initiative, CRI, with Teddy's close friend Mathilde Krim of the activist group of AMFAR and Martin Delaney of Project Inform. Their proposal was to create a parallel-track approval system that would allow community AIDS doctors to conduct clinical studies on the off-the-shelf drugs that neither pharma nor NIAID wanted to test. Delaney, who did not have AIDS but made his bones in the movement, smuggling ribavirin from Mexico for the buyer's clubs, described the parallel track program as medically supervised guerrilla drug trials. Appealing to his friend Senator Orrin Hatch's Mormon sense of compassion toward the ill, Senator Kennedy had recruited the Utah conservative Republican to co-champion the AIDS issue. Independent-minded Connecticut Senator Lowell Weicker was another key ally. Those three most powerful senators, from three different political perspectives, worked in tandem and with Waxman and Weiss in the House. Their coordinated bipartisan efforts freed up hundreds of millions of dollars from the White House bean counters over the objections of powerful Christian conservatives who framed AIDS as God's just punishment for the homosexual lifestyle. For 2 years, Senator Kennedy and Barron vainly urged Dr. Fauci to create a parallel track. Kennedy was frustrated by Dr. Fauci's reticence to listen to the HIV community. He considered it petty, cruel, and irresponsible that Dr. Fauci would not allow testing of the Buyers Club drugs. In a September 2007 interview, Dr. Fauci recalled the urgency that Teddy brought to the topic. He said that Kennedy urged him, "We've got to have a clinical trial process that reaches out to the community." He was really the one who pushed very hard for the community program for clinical research on AIDS. That was one of his big agenda items. He wanted to get community access to clinical trials at the community level, not just limited to the trials run by drug companies and NIAID. By 1987, Dr. Fauci's political partners from all parties realized that Dr. Fauci's program was in shambles. Despite the millions from Congress, not a single AIDS drug had emerged from NIAID's pipeline. Senator Kennedy was beginning to suspect that Dr. Fauci was either inept or in the tank with pharma. Ronald Reagan was pushing to transfer the entire AIDS effort to more efficient private pharmaceutical companies. Dr. Fauci's failed predictions, organizational inadequacies, and obfuscations had steamed his Capitol Hill allies past their boiling points. In the spring of 1988, Dr. Fauci's congressional sponsors turned on him during a dramatic Capitol Hill confrontation. The April 28th hearing began with Representative Weiss, perhaps Dr. Fauci's most loyal sponsor, demanding that the NIAID chief explain his snail's progress. Dr. Fauci responded by whining that he had no budget to purchase lab space, computers, desks, and office supplies, or to hire new workers. The stunned Upper West Side congressman reminded Dr. Fauci that he had accepted $374 million from Congress for AIDS research. It seemed astonishing that those sums were insufficient to purchase clerical supplies and furniture. Oblivious that his lame excuses were only stoking his benefactor's scorching rage, Fauci moaned that his office items required separate budget columns not provided for in the massive congressional appropriation. In a barely controlled fury, Representative Waxman coldly asked Dr. Fauci why he never informed his congressional mentors of this logjam. That question provoked a cavalcade of vague and dissembling bellyaching, during which Dr. Fauci suggested obliquely that he had feared antagonizing the Reagan White House, which might have frowned on his cozy bonhomie with congressional Dems. Dr. Fauci's fuzzy equivocation prompted Representative Waxman to darken visibly. He was furious, recounts Nussbaum. He practically levitated out of his chair. California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi complained of Dr. Fauci's lackluster performance that, from our perspective, we have a burning building behind us, and we're coming to you all for water, and we're finding out that there's not somebody there to turn on the faucet. Pelosi next delivered the coup de grace, as Nussbaum chronicled the explosive exchange. Representative Pelosi asked Dr. Fauci to assume that he had AIDS and found himself dying of pneumonia. You know the theory behind aerosol pentamidine to prevent pneumonia is strong. You know that the aerosol pentamidine was evaluated by the NIH as highly promising. You know that many studies in San Francisco recommend it routinely, and that it is available. Would you take aerosol pentamidine, or would you wait for a study? For 3 years, Dr. Fauci had done everything in his power to deny aerosol pentamidine and its companion drug, Bactrim, to AIDS sufferers. But here's what he told the panel in 1988. If I were an individual patient, I would probably take aerosolized pentamidine if I already had a bout of pneumocystis. In fact, I might try, even before then, taking prophylactic Bactrim. These were two promising remedies that everyone on the panel and in the audience knew that Fauci had refused to either test or recommend. At that very moment, Dr. Fauci was denying tens of thousands of AIDS patients access to these life-saving remedies. Nussbaum describes the scene that followed. Silence. There was dead silence in room 2154 of the Rayburn House office building. People at the hearing just stared at Fauci and at one another. Here was the head of the NIH effort against AIDS publicly admitting that he personally would not follow the government's own guidelines and recommendations. Here was a top government scientist basically admitting that the government effort should be circumvented by the millions of people with AIDS. Here was Tony Fauci openly calling for the prophylaxis of pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, while his own clinical trials system did not have a single preventative drug in trial. It was a truly mind-wrenching admission. Fauci himself was calling into question the very foundation of the government's entire research effort against AIDS. 32 years later, Dr. Fauci performed an encore of this kabuki dance during the early COVID crisis. On March 24, 2020, he answered a question from a journalist by admitting that if he became ill with COVID, he would take hydroxychloroquine as his remedy. Shortly thereafter, Dr. Fauci launched his aggressive campaign to deny HCQ and all early treatments to the rest of humanity. Dr. Fauci's 1988 Capitol Hill performance left all his former friends wanting a piece of him. Fauci was in deep trouble. These were his supporters, his financial mentors, his political protectors from an administration that was so aligned against the gay community and so ideologically antagonistic to the very existence of the NIH that it wanted pharma to privatize the whole shebang. Now, Weiss and Waxman were clearly gunning for him. Fauci realized that the entire hearing was a setup to show his personal shortcomings. Larry Kramer was thunderstruck. When he read about the NIH delays, the ineptitude, and perhaps the moral cowardice behind them, Kramer lost control. On May 31, 1988, Kramer wrote his famous open letter to Tony Fauci in the Village Voice. Kramer's diatribe compared NIAID to the fraternity of miscreants, delinquents, and dim-witted knuckleheads in the comedy film Animal House. He called Dr. Fauci an idiot and a murderer. He described Fauci sweating and squirming under Representative Ted Weiss's questioning. "You were pummeled into admitting publicly what some have been claiming since you took over some 3 years ago. You have admitted that you are an incompetent idiot." Said Kramer, "You expect us to buy this bullshit and feel sorry for you? You fucking son of a bitch of a dumb idiot. You have had $374 million, and you expect us to buy this garbage of excuses." Kramer accused Fauci of keeping his mouth shut for 36 months to pander to the Reagan White House. He asked Fauci, "Why did you keep quiet for so long, while people perished in the pandemic?" It reminded him, he said, of Hitler's good lieutenant, Adolf Eichmann. He accused Fauci of being too cowardly and self-involved to speak up until forced to by a congressional committee. "We lie down and die, and our bodies pile up higher and higher in hospitals and homes and hospices and streets and doorways." Referring to aerosol pentamidine, Kramer pointed out, "We know and hear what is working on some of us somewhere. You couldn't care less about what we say. You won't answer our phone calls or letters, or listen to anyone in our stricken community. What tragic pomposity." How many years ago did we tell you about aerosol pentamidine, Tony? That this stuff saves lives, and we discovered it ourselves. We came to you bearing this great news on a silver platter as a gift. Begging you, can we get it officially tested? Can we get it approved by you so that insurance companies and Medicaid will pay for it, as well as other drugs we beg you to test, as a routine treatment, and our patients going broke for medicine can get it cheaper? You monster. We tell you what the good drugs are. You don't test them, and you tell us to get them on the streets. You continue to pass down word from on high that you don't like this drug or that drug, when you haven't even tested them. There are more AIDS patients dead because you didn't test drugs on them, Kramer said, than because you did. After the congressional hearing, everyone realized that the little emperor had no clothes. Dr. Fauci recognized that his political life was dangling by a thread. He had spent hundreds of millions of dollars building a drug testing network that didn't work. The Congress he had always been able to charm, double-talk, and bamboozle had finally called fraud. His only hope for reputation and career salvation was a dramatic and unexpected change. He had been tarred with an incompetence brush by the very people who were his major supporters in the past. Only a complete change of strategy could resuscitate Tony Fauci's career. If he was to continue receiving financial support for AIDS research from Congress, if he was to continue being the head of NIAID, he had to reinvent himself. Dr. Fauci's strategic pivot. Anthony Fauci needed a makeover, and this master of bureaucratic survival responded to his existential crisis with a breathtaking pivot. Suddenly, Dr. Fauci turned to embrace the AIDS activists he had previously reviled. In the summer of 1989, he accosted Larry Kramer on a Montreal street during an international AIDS conference, took him for a walk, effectively begged forgiveness, and proposed a working partnership. He began testing AIDS community drugs in parallel trials, as Senator Kennedy and AMFAR had long requested. Dr. Fauci partnered with the AIDS doctors, the contemporary equivalents of frontline COVID-19 healers Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Richard Urso, and Dr. Ryan Cole, among others, giving them authority and millions of dollars to launch local community research initiative programs, CRIs, that allowed community AIDS clinics to test promising drugs outside the formal clinical trial programs dominated by Dr. Fauci's pharma PIs and to quickly win federal approvals. Fauci himself was now trying to build a system that consisted of greater access to drugs at a much earlier stage in the testing game, said Nussbaum. In a gesture of reconciliation with his biggest critics, Dr. Fauci named the Parallel Track program after Senator Kennedy's aide, Terry Barron, and he gave Larry Kramer a seat at the table. Most ironically, in light of his successful campaign to sabotage hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin during the COVID crisis, Dr. Fauci suddenly dropped his knee-jerk insistence that every drug needed randomized placebo-controlled testing prior to approval. In an extraordinary volte-face, he fiercely argued that if a drug looked promising for alleviating potentially lethal illness during pandemics, patients ought to be able to get access to it, even if it hadn't been through a double-blind placebo trial. In a brassy display of chutzpah and brazenly hypocritical misdirection, he questioned the ethics of FDA regulators who insisted on placebo testing of beneficial drugs during a global pandemic when people were dying. He seemed to have forgotten that this was precisely his posture until just a few weeks before. Dr. Fauci accused the FDA of foot-dragging and overmanaging drug development. He openly attacked NIAID's sister agency for its cruel and rigid insistence on randomized double-blind placebo testing for DHPG, a promising remedy for retinal herpes. In order to quiet the AIDS community, Tony Fauci even put AL721 into trials. Dr. Fauci became a vocal cheerleader of parallel-track approval of the retinue of popular buyers club drugs. "It doesn't make any sense," he said, "to deprive those people of the choice of whether or not they want to take a chance on a drug that has proven to be effective, as long as it doesn't interfere with clinical trials. As a scientist, I think it's an appropriate thing to do." Fauci transformed himself in the summer of 1989. He became an aggressive advocate for speeding up testing and drug approval for all life-threatening diseases, not just AIDS, recalls Nussbaum. Fauci adopted virtually the entire ACT UP program at once and as a whole. It was the kind of flip-flop that comes with a true religious conversion. It was so startling that it appeared as if Fauci had found the light, had an epiphany, and transformed himself into another being. This sudden flip-flop presaged Dr. Fauci's 2021 neck-wrenching switcheroo when he suddenly demanded an investigation of the Wuhan lab after energetically forestalling that inquiry for over a year. By the end of 1989, his insurrection against his own old orthodoxies and his merciless attacks on the beleaguered satraps at FDA had made Dr. Anthony Fauci into something of a hero to some in the HIV community. Industry to the rescue. Not everyone was happy. Dr. Fauci's U-turn had infuriated his industry PIs. Big Pharma's frontline troopers were in open revolt against his ballyhooed reforms. The CRI system was proving a disaster for the industry. The AIDS community's network of 200 CRI doctors was testing anti-AIDS drugs in parallel-track programs with low-cost and quick enrollments. The community doctors, Nussbaum explained in 1990, know more about treatment than do Dr. Fauci's ivory tower PIs, hidden away from the realities of life and driven by